I'm very happy to this opportunity to return here after many years. I think 12 years or something like that. And I'm this is my here today, gone tomorrow odyssey across North America. So tomorrow I'll be going to Seattle. Will finally be able to answer the question how a mountain can be clear. They made this, they gave this name like Clear Mountain. I don't know what that means. How can you have mountains are solid, aren't they? Anyway, that would be one. One thing I hope I'll learn in Seattle. One of the teachings of the Lord Buddha refers to the noble lineage, the lineage of noble ones. And the characteristics of members of the noble lineage. And the fourth of the four Dhammas in this group, that the noble ones, those of the noble lineage, find joy in the abandoning of the unwholesome and the development of the wholesome. So this work has been joyful work when you not it's often unpleasant and living in community is particularly difficult. Buddhist monks don't need hair shirts, they just live together. It fulfills the same function. But we are comforted, maybe, by this beautiful teaching that if you go to the top of a mountain, you have these jagged rocks, and you see the rocks by the side of the river, and they're all beautiful and rounded. So the idea being that it's better to be a rounded rock than a jagged rock, which maybe you say, well, it's a matter of taste, but this is the underlying teaching that we rub against each other and we rub each other's hard edges and jagged edges and we become smooth and beautiful. And we can find joy in that, even as I say, moment by moment, it's kind of difficult, particularly when people have different ideas of who you are than you have. But seeing it in the context of the abandonment of defilement, you realize there's no other way. The Buddha gave us this, such a succinct practical teaching, the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha is conditioned by ignorance manifesting as craving. So when we say craving is the second of the Noble Truths, yes, that's correct, of course, but we need to understand that there's ignorance in parenthesis following craving, because craving is the expression of ignorance. And the Buddha referred to Nibbana as the ultimate happiness, Paramang Sukham. And the cause, the condition for the realization of ultimate happiness is the Eightfold Path. Just this simple teaching, we can use that and reflect on that for a whole lifetime. It's so simple and yet so profound. For instance, when we're in living in community, whether it's in family or in a group of people or a company or whatever, whenever human beings come together and there is some mental distress of some level or another, we come back to this Four Noble Truths. That without ignorant craving, there can be no suffering. So, if we compare physical suffering and mental suffering, we can see a clear distinction. For instance, ordinary, unenlightened, uninstructed human being puts their hand in a flame. And their hand will burn because that's the nature of heat, the nature of skin. It's the law of nature. An arahant puts his hand into a flame and it will burn. The arahants and the Buddha are not immune to physical pain. The last year of his life, the Lord Buddha walking towards Kusinara, giving a Dhamma talk to the Sangha, and he says, Ananda, spread out my Sanghati over there. I want to go and lay down. My back hurts. You give the Dhamma talk from now on. I've had enough for tonight. But even the Buddha got a backache and suffered from all the aches and pains of a normal human being, but it was a physical pain. So I'm proposing that anybody who puts their hand in a flame will experience more or less the same results. Their hand will get burnt if they hold it there long enough. But let's take the case of a mental pain. Somebody says something nasty to you. Somebody treats you with contempt. That's the worst one, isn't it? They roll their eyes and say, "Here we go again." It's like this is somebody came up to me on the top of a hill the other day. He said, "Are you a Buddhist monk?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I want to ask you a question. What do you do if somebody treats you with contempt? You know, it's such a burning thing. You know, you see a stranger in the middle of nowhere and you want to know, how do I deal with this? Painful." But the first reflection we have is someone with no training, no Buddhist educational development of interest in the mind and how the mind works can be devastated by words of contempt. Someone who has started to practice more mindful than they used to be, a little bit more careful, a little kinder, a little bit more patient, so on. They find that when they are treated in that kind of dismissive way or spoken to with some contempt, they feel it, of course, but yet it's not quite as bad as it used to be. And then when we, as we develop more and more, it's one of the Aryavamsa, one of the noble lineage, and we go to the Arahant, they can be treated with the utmost contempt and experience no mental suffering. So this is such an important distinction to make. Physical pain is not interested in your spiritual welfare at all. And you know, these days, you know, you can eat all the right foods and you can exercise and take all the supplements and know how to do all these special breathing exercises and go jogging every day and yoga and tai chi and qigong and everything. And you can still get sick, you know. And then people feel, wow, it's like, how many hours have I wasted working out and all this sort of uninterested, bland foods I'd ate because I thought they were good for me. And now I should have just stayed with like greasy bacon. And but like eating well and living well is smarter than the opposite, but it's not a guarantee. You know, there's no guarantees in the physical world. Because there's factor X. Factor X is unquantifiable, unpredictable, unknowable. It's karma from past lives, and we don't know when that's going to pop up in our life. It could be any time at all. That's why we need to be alert and awake and ready for whatever happens. But this is the physical. But the mental realm, the suffering that we experience mentally is clearly correlated to our practice of the Dhamma, clearly correlated to the intensity of craving, the depth of ignorance. So this is where our, you know, if we have, we only want to use the word hope, but this is where the word hope comes in Buddhism at least, because there's always something we can do. Physically, not necessarily. But mentally, spiritually, there's always something we can do. Because change occurs in a systematic way, that is to say, according to causes and conditions. It's not random. It's not an act of God. And we as human beings are capable of discerning the causes and conditions of progress, the causes and conditions of regress, what makes us happier and what makes us unhappier. For instance, if you've been in a very traumatic situation in the past, you've been traumatized by it, then there are going to be physical echoes of that, or the karma, the results of that physically. But mentally, it's not fixed. And you can observe certain ways of thinking about what happened to you, increase the anger, the angst, and the suffering. Certain ways of thinking about what happened, lessen, reduce the suffering. So, although you have not so much influence on the physical, although it is affected some way by the mental, you have work you can do. You can learn to observe and to develop ways of thinking and framing and reflecting on what happened that minimize the defilements, minimize the dukkha, and maximize the well-being that can be salvaged from whatever happened. You have ideas like, why me? Yes, that's the worst one, isn't it? Why not? Yeah, why not you? Things happen according to causes and conditions. If you have an idea of yourself as a damaged human being, that's a common one these days. A damaged human being. What does that mean? Yeah, as I say, if you like, you can be physically affected by something, and that can have long-lasting detrimental effects. But mental damage can be mediated, can be reduced, and even if it cannot be 100% eliminated, we do the best we can. It's like life is often making the best of a bad situation. No. And we have the tools that we can do that if we really apply ourselves consistently. So when we experience suffering in a social context, somebody does something, somebody says something, and we feel we're aware there's that mindfulness that we don't feel good about this. Our first question is, where is the craving? So we you know, it's like you have this when I this is a school story. When I was at school, I was hopeless at science. Physics was a torment. And one year we got the new textbook at the beginning of the year, and I looked at the back. And all the answers to the exercises were in the back. I thought, like, bingo. It was like, wow, it's like I've hit the jackpot. They forgot to take the answers because previous years they sort of cut the answer. And then I realized, no, you have to prove how you got from the question to the answer. It didn't really help very much. Well, it did because it gave you kind of a direction to move in. And so, in Dhamma, we know the answer. We've all heard the teachings, but it's how you get from the question to the answer, which is the difficult thing. That's where we're putting our effort in. So we know the answer. The answer is that whatever anybody says, whatever anybody does, no matter how obnoxious and nasty and aggressive people behave towards you, you will not suffer unless there is craving in your mind. It's just not correct to say someone made me suffer. No one person can make another person suffer. It's not possible. It just doesn't happen. All that people can do, situations can create, are conditions. But if we divide between causes and conditions, so there is a confluence of the cause and the conditions. So if you have all of the conditions, but you don't have the basic cause, nothing can happen. This is a co-production. Dukkha is a co-production. And so you are very limited power, influence over other people's behavior, but you can potentially have a great deal of influence on your own response to what happens and these triggers. And being aware and being interested and curious and looking and learning from what goes on in your heart, your body moment. This is the path of practice. So when we say he shouldn't have done that, how dare he? Who does he think he is? It's just like, that person behaved as they did, they spoke as they did because of a number of causes and conditions. So we're moving towards process, moving towards causes and conditions rather than looking in terms of individuals and people. And this goes so much against the flow. I mean, coming to America, so things like everything's named after somebody here, every road, every park, every highway, every patch of grass has got a name on it. Why, what's the fuss? I mean, I'm not going to remember even, an hour later. You don't have to tell me your name, because you offered a highway or you dug something, planted something, But it's like this world where we're persuaded that, our value and is I you want to be remembered, you want to be known, you want to be seen, you want to be why? Never mind. So one of my slogans this year is you're all unique. Just like a QR code is unique. Yeah, how do you feel about that? Is it depressing? No, it's not. It's liberating. So not saying that he did this to me, but when that or if we use that phrasing, that person had that much understanding, that much restraint, that much kindness, that much generosity, that much cruelty, that much callousness, so there are all these different mental states arising and passing away. And the ones that have been indulged in and encouraged and fed will be stronger than the ones that have been overlooked and starved. And it's just a simple thing. At that moment, the mental state that arose in that person was due to all the causes and conditions in that person's life or many lives before it. And so seeing things in terms of causation takes out that poisonous arrow of self. And to use another analogy, that's the fly in the soup. However delicious the soup, there's one big fly in it, you don't want to eat it anymore. And no matter how good life is, you need that fly of me and mine, and the whole thing, you have to throw it out. It spoils everything. So no, just notice this whenever there's some real strong feeling and suffering, just the intensity of this word, me, how dare he treat me? How can he treat me with such disrespect or contempt, and he and she and me and mine and her, this is quite crazy stuff. Just don't get caught up in all that. Or we look in our own behavior in the past, people carrying around this idea of themselves as being a bad person. I mean, what could be more idiotic than that? Why are you a bad person? Well, I did this bad thing. Yeah, you did a bad thing. Why does that make you a bad person? Well, get a bit confused here. So when I have this conversation, I would say, well, look, go back to this bad thing you did. The thing you don't want anybody to know, and you think if anybody knew this, nobody would want to even speak to me ever again. Thank God nobody knows. I say, go back to this thing and list what exactly happened. And what happened was, as I say, you got that much mindfulness, you got that much patience, that much wisdom, that much restraint, and you've got this much greed and this much anger and this much conceit. Well, how can you be surprised who comes out on top? You know, what's the confusion here? But looking at it in that way, then you can see your path forward. Yes, sir. Okay, I can't do anything about that, but in future, I've got to shrink the amount of greed, shrink the amount of hatred, shrink the amount of conceit, and I've got to grow and nurture the mindfulness and the patience and the kindness and all these positive qualities. And so when it comes to a conflict, they are the ones that are going to win out in future. It's not rocket science. I was thinking, what do people in NASA say? You know, it's like I reckon people in NASA, they say, look, this is not the Paticca Samuppada. Anyway, that's probably not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is like looking at things in causes, in terms of causes and conditions, rather than in terms of me and mine and him and her and this is not a philosophy and it's not kind of a trick, but it's really what goes on. And again, if we take an analogy, like the untrained mind is like a windscreen of a car, which is all dirty, and so you can't really trust what you see through that windscreen. But if you clean the windscreen, then what you see is much clearer and more reliable. So it's not that these things are equally valid, okay? Okay, you see things through a clean screen, I see things through a dirty screen. Who's to say that your view is any better than mine? We all have our own views. Yeah, but there is a difference between looking through a clean screen and a dirty screen. So we're not, it's not all sort of just equal. There is some evaluation and some judgment that can be made. So making valid judgments is not the same as being judgmental. Judgmental, don't be judgmental. It's like a terrible thing, isn't it, to be judgmental? But being, making good judgments and saying, from my experience, sometimes people criticize me because I leave my glasses in my yam and they get a bit, how can you use your glasses? Like my brother, he just give me them and he just cleans them for me. And I put them on, I said, yeah, it's definitely an improvement. It's not one and the same thing, just a different view. Some views are superior to other views. Seeing through glasses that have been cleaned is better. Good eyesight's better than bad eyesight. Good hearing's better than bad hearing. These are not just sort of different ways of experiencing the world. And like, and we should respect, hard of hearing in the same way as good hearing, and we shouldn't prioritize good hearing over bad. Well, yeah, we should actually, because it's a lot more reliable. If somebody says, get out of the way, there's a car coming, then having good hearing is better than bad hearing. So this is our criteria. We notice that certain things, when we have a confused mind, seem really real and substantial and convincing. But the more mindful we become, like the less convincing they become, and the more kind of flimsy and insubstantial and other things, maybe kind of not so clear when we're confused. But when we're more mindful, we notice that they become more meaningful. Like when you're meditating, you're just sitting there, and suddenly you think, my goodness, what a fuss I'm making about. It's just such a small little thing. And if you don't give your time yourself that kind of time, because meditation is basically quality time with your mind, okay? So sit with your mind, and this stuff pops up, you know. So just suddenly realize it's so obvious, but somehow you never saw it. And then your mind's a little bit more mindful, a little calm. It's not like deep samadhi or anything, but you see, that's just not worth it. I'm just so much suffering over such a small thing. Got to let that go. And then otherwise, there can be this, you're sitting there and you're thinking, whoa, hold on. This is not a small thing at all. This is really a big issue. I really need to sort this out. But this is the first like green shoots of wisdom. You know, it's just like a reassessment of things that you're caught up with in your life. It's not that you lack the intelligence, the insight necessary to see that you're making a mountain out of a molehill, or that you're making a molehill out of a mountain, but you need to give yourself that time and that space. You know, this is what mindfulness does. So we can make judgments in this way, and we can say, the more mindful we are, the more present we are, the more trustworthy our assessments, our valuations, our judgments, the more confused, the more angry, the more upset, the more anxious, the less we can trust our minds. And one of the teachings I give to people in Thailand is like, if you're overly confident, you know, people say self-confident, but what they mean is like really confident in their views and opinions. So if you're really confident in your views and opinions to the extent that, you know, it's deaf to other people's feelings and views, you go into a meeting or something, you have a mantra. Your mantra is, I might be wrong, I might be wrong, I might be wrong, you see. But if you're one of these people that say, "My, you know, I don't have anything worth saying," you know, it's like I'm always wrong, and say, "I might be right, I might be right, I might be right." See? So you can just train your mind, but you're not taking your mind at face value because you've learned over and over again it's tricky. It's not, your mind's not a reliable witness. You know, you can't trust it, but you can develop, cultivate the mind to the level where your mind is trustworthy. So it's not inherently untrustworthy, but unless it's been trained systematically and consistently, it is untrustworthy. But if, so you can, you know, a lot of early practice is like, sort of extrapolation. So what I mean by that is like, let's say we have teachings on heaven realms and hell realms, and so people say, well, yeah, I like this mindfulness, and that all makes sense. But that heaven realm and hell realm, I don't know about that stuff. And but the analogy that I like to explain the attitude to these things is, you're given a, you live in a flat. Where's a flat place in America? Like in the Central Plains, Idaho. Is Idaho, is that flat? No, Idaho's not. Kansas. Okay, you're living in Kansas, and you've never seen a mountain before. Like like you see like a little sort of like, oh wow, hills ahead, you know, something like that. And then there's a tornado and you're no longer in Kansas. You've blown out of Kansas. And you arrive in this strange land. Fortunately, you've been given a map by a very kind-hearted wizard. And so you're leading your friends along, and Scarecrow and Tin Man and you're looking at your map, and you're looking for left, and you look to the right, and you check it on the map, and it's completely accurate. You weren't sure when you start off, is there some kind of city ahead, some kind of, you don't know. But you say, well, let before I, I really need to check this is a good map. But every single thing you check on the map is correct. And then Tin Man says he needs some oiling, and so and the straw man's feeling a bit weary in his limbs. So you sit down and you open up the map, and you see these things called mountains. Okay, and how what 5,000 meter mountain? It's like, come on, really? But then you think, this is just one map made by, is it likely? How likely is it that this map, which I just entered at a random point, blown here from a tornado from Kansas, and yet every single thing that I've observed is correct. Is it likely that this will be completely incorrect? And I think a reasonable conclusion is, well, it's just one map, and I can't imagine what that would be like, but I'll take it as a working hypothesis for now because I have trust in this map. So this is the analogy, like the teachings of the Lord Buddha. These are not dogmas. What kind of relationship do you need with the ultimate Godhead? What ceremonies do you need? What sort of stuff, and punishment and reward and all that kind of, realm. But the Buddha is starting off just making these observations and pointing to things about your body and your mind. And if you act with generosity and kindness, makes you feel good. It's a very pure kind of joy, and it's lasts a long time. The kind of pleasure you get from sights, sounds, and so on is intense, but it's very short-lived. If you act kindly, do something good with a selfless intention, with no desire for any kind of reward, then the recollection of that will bring you joy the whole of your life. Whereas if you act kindly, you perform acts of generosity with some desire for reward, whether it's a material reward or it's simply recognition, respect, love, whatever it might be. When you recollect that act of goodness, afterwards, your memory is of a transaction. That's what's recorded in your mind. And so recollection, memory of selfless acts of kindness are a treasure of the heart. So this is something you can, it's not a matter of now I'm a Buddhist, I have to believe this. You can start looking at, does that make sense? Is there any time I've acted in the past, done a good thing, but really wanted something in return? How do I feel about that now? Kind of, nothing much. In Thai, we say "chui chui." It's like, it's okay. But then, when you remember something you did in the past, and you feel and you did it with a pure intention, immediately you feel good. If you're sick and you're depressed and you're lonely, and you remember like 10 years ago, I ate this incredible meal. Does it feel you? How does that affect your mind? Or I had a wonderful holiday 5 years ago. Yeah, well, okay, chui chui. But you remember, so, like I have so many memories. I was hitchhiking from Pakistan to Afghanistan. I was in the Khyber Pass. And for some reason, I don't know why now, I'd had my hair shut and I had a long ponytail at the back. And I got picked up by two, a Hare Krishna businessmen from California. And they assumed, reasonably enough, that, I was a Hare Krishna, and I wasn't. And they never met someone like me, like traveling, across Pakistan, Afghanistan, on like on $1 a day and hitchhiking. And they were fascinated, and we got on really well. And I was in a taxi, like a proper, I'd been sort of on the back of pickup trucks, standing, off Afghanistan, standing there in the back of a pickup truck with all these guys, the only one without a rifle and bullets across their chest. And we got to Kabul, and I said, "Where are you staying?" I'm saying, "I'm staying at Chicken Street," and they're going to the Kabul Hilton. I said, "Well, Chicken Street, where's that?" I said, "That's where, all the hippies hang out. It's the cheap place. How much does it cost for a night in a room?" I said, "I don't know, maybe equivalent of 30 cents or something like that." "What? They can't believe it." And so this guy, we get out of the car, and this was so kind, and they just, we'd had such a good time together, and he just gave me $50, $50 bill. I mean, this is the mid-1970s, $50. It's incredible, and such kindness. And I thought, I don't really need this money. I tell you what I'll do. If I meet somebody who needs this more than I do today, I'll give it to them. So I went to a tea shop. And within a very short time, this young English guy walks in. He looks absolutely, it's like this, drawn and white. And I said, "Come and sit down. What's wrong?" He said, "Oh, I just had my wallet stolen, all my traveler's checks, all my money gone. Thank goodness I got my passport in my other pocket." And I said, "Sit down. Good news for you." Bought him a cup of tea, give him the $50. And this is like what, 50, almost 50 years ago now. And the moment I remember this, I just feel, you can see, I just feel so joyful that I did that. And this is nothing special. I mean, you've all, if you think hard enough, you can come across occasions. These are your treasures. These are the treasures of your heart. Look after them because they'll bring you joy whenever you're lonely and you're depressed and you're down and you're sick. Bring this acts of goodness. You have these treasures already within you. You don't have to go and find them elsewhere. Now, this is a kind of teaching that I'm comparing with you're on a map, you just arrived from Kansas and you're looking from left to right and everything. And because every time you put the Buddha's teaching, and I'm speaking with someone who's been doing this with quite a critical mind for 50 more years, every single teaching of the Buddha, yes, that's so true. Oh, yeah. And this is how faith in Buddhism arises. It's not just adopting dogmas, but it's like, yes. Yes, that's so true. Yeah, it really, that's, and this is the accumulation of faith. In Buddha Dhamma is the accumulation of these yes moments, and they can be really kind of everyday. And all, yes, and there's never a single, not even a single, "No, the Buddha got that one wrong." Yeah, it was a real off day, never, it's just yes. So then, when you these teachings that you haven't realized, you this trust, yeah. So, are there heaven realms and hell realms and all this thing? I don't know. So this is the other really cool thing about Buddhists. We're not ashamed of saying we don't know. Actually, kind of proud. I don't know. Yeah, it says heaven realms. I don't know, but I really trust in the wisdom of the Buddha, and that trust is based upon years and years of putting his teachings to the test of experience, and he's never ever let me down. So I'm trusting him on this one. And a lot of times, well, when we say we don't believe in something, And you know what? Why not? Because I can't imagine it. So let's get this clear. You mean your ability to create a mental image of something is the criteria of whether or not it really exists. Is that correct? Yeah. Well, that's not very wise, is it? Yeah. It's like if I can think about it, if I can make a picture of it, it must be true. And no, I can't. Heaven realm, heaven can't. No, it's like. So I don't think that's really good. I prefer to trust the Buddha, and keep working away and learning. And so my other slogan this year is enjoy your Buddhist life. You know, it's just how fortunate we are to have this kind of teaching where you don't have to anesthetize your critical intelligence. You're encouraged to ask questions and investigate and penetrate and really put every single teaching to the test because it stands up to the test. This is what ahipassika means. Like it stands up to the test. And that's how the faith and the confidence and the momentum continuity of practice comes when it's powered by this faith based upon the effort to put to the test of experience each of the Buddha's teachings.